Hello and welcome to the End of Seeking podcast with myself, Martin, and
me, Imogen.
We're at episode 31, I think. So welcome. Do you have any announcements?
I do. I've got quite a few things going on, coming up at least. First thing is, other than my weekly groups, which is Wednesdays and Sundays, next week I have a 5-day diving deep retreat, which starts on Wednesday the 10th of April and goes until the Sunday the 14th of April. So anyone who wants to join that, just note that registration is required and get in touch if anyone wants to attend, but finances are tricky. There's no one be turned away for that reason.
So you have a whole scholarship thing going on.
Yeah, I have a scholarship program now. And after that is actually my book is being released.
Cool.
On the 24th of April. It's available for pre-order on ebook, and both ebook and print will be released on the 24th, and you can find out about that on my website.
That's exciting. What's it called?
It's called The Heart That Knows.
And it's a book of sort of poetry?
It is, it is. It's a very meditative poetry. It's a transmission, so that's the intention behind it. And then lastly, I've got an in-person, I know it's quite a ways out right now, but I want to just let people know about this now because there's limited space. And that is an in-person day-long retreat in Glastonbury, UK on the 18th of May. And the early bird tickets end on the 18th of April. So anyone that wants to join it, it is starting to book up. So I just wanted to mention
that. So that's you and another...
It is. A dear friend of mine. We're old school friends. We've been sort of together in various ways on this path throughout. Mm. And she's a very gifted sound healer. And we're going to have a really beautiful retreat. It's called Journey into the Heart.
So. Beautiful. Glastonbury's amazing. This is real energetically, well, important place. It's full of power.
Beautiful place. And we're going to be visiting sacred sites as part of the retreat. We'll sit together in some really beautiful spots there.
Cool. That'd be exciting.
Yeah. So that's, there's lots going on for me, but those are the headlines there.
Great.
How about you? What's going on with you?
I recently did a month of what I called the Spiritual Foundation series, and that was really lovely. Each week I was doing satsang, but looking at it from a sort of a spiritual lens, and so I finished that. That's done now. I did 5 weeks of that, and it was really lovely to get going again because I haven't really been doing any public offering of satsang or anything like that for about 5 years.
Yeah, you took a bit of a hiatus.
I took a deep, deep inward hiatus. I was still doing one-on-ones, but I was, not doing anything public. Mm. So anyway, Spiritual Foundation's done, but I've decided to keep going. I'm offering a satsang group on Saturdays every week, most weeks. I mean, some weeks I'll... like when you're doing a retreat, I won't do one that week. So every Saturday, 5 p.m. UK time, I'm going to be doing satsang. So come inquire deeply, or just, as I say, bask in the bliss of being. Satsang is a real place of holding, a real place of energetic benefit. So it'll be, I'll start with a meditation, then we'll have a satsang talk Q&A, and then we'll do a divine light transmission at the end of that. So that'll be every Saturday.
How has that been to be sort of diving into that world again after taking a step back, that inward call for 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different, it's beautiful. I mean, it's different. It's such a different experience to holding satsang in a group than to the one-on-one. Mm. One-on-one's really... really, really powerful, really, really a juicy place to sort of inquire into, deeply look into one's true nature and all that goes along with that. But the group is just a different dynamic. It allows for a different quality of expression, and it has a sort of its own collective energy. It's quite supportive. There's something about people come when more people enter into the group. It itself elevates the group.
Definitely.
And the potency of that presence. I love that. There's a quote. You know, there's a biblical idea. You know, in the Jesus says something like, you know, whenever two or three come together in my name, there I will be among you.
Yes, love that quote.
And, you know, if you take that from that idea, that wherever two or three or more gather together in the name of truth, in the name of like sat, I love the satsang, sat, truth, reality, and sangha, which is this coming together, this gathering, this community, that has such power to it. So, come together for truth, for that exploration and that recognition. So that's what, so Saturdays at 5 p.m. Short TLDR.
Nice.
So we were talking earlier, and what were you saying? You said the other night we were going to jump off here. You had a bit of a interesting night. So you had a bit of a download to add some context to this conversation late the other night. When a new book emerged, chapter by chapter by chapter, or section literally, by section by section, just kept you up for hours.
It did.
On your phone, writing, capturing the download.
Yeah. I had, just to go back a step even further, I'm just finishing, about to publish my first book.
Yeah.
And I had a second book in mind and a third one after that. But it's actually the contents of the third one got downloaded to me.
What you thought was going to be the third one.
What I thought was going to be the third one.
So here's the point. What you were talking about, there was some of the things that are coming up in these points of biographical interest were about how one refuses the call. Let's say one doesn't discern it, or you refuses it, or you half do it, or you're being called to something, but you're not listening,
fully in.
You're not able to or willing to, or but the call is there somehow, right? But it's only on retrospect you go, oh, I was being called there.
Yeah, I look back now and I go, I can see some very distinct periods of time that happened not infrequently, actually, every few months or a few years at least, every year or so, that I was being called to something, and I just wasn't quite ready to fully accept it into my heart, what I was being called to.
Can you give an example of what that was?
Well, the main thing is to this work.
To the work,
To transmissions, to speaking with people. But I think more generally, it also turns up in a call to the spiritual path.
Because, I mean, even before, before the big shift, there was a glimpse shift.
There
that
was.
That actually changed you. We've talked about that before. You changed that, that you were kind of, you weren't really, you were doing it. I was deeply into satsang and pursuing these things and heading for retreats, and you were like, okay, I'll come along, whatever, but you know, maybe not.
Oh yeah, massive ambivalence to all of it.
Yeah, but then maybe the one time you had a huge non-dual glimpse, and that changed you.
Yeah, and that I'd say that was maybe not the first call, but one of the first major recognitions of that. Looking back, that's what I see it as now.
Yeah.
It's like a big call to discover my nature.
So, but since the big shift into non-duality, let's say, you've talked about just now about more recent, times where, you know, you were called and you didn't quite hear it or didn't quite follow it? Or
I heard it, but I didn't fully embrace it in my heart. And it came, though that call came in many different forms, actually. Sometimes it was an outer, sometimes a call, sometimes it was an inner call, sometimes it was a metaphysical call, let's say.
Sure.
But each time it was the same call, actually. And I guess it was the call of the mystic. I think right. We were just talking about that, and that's...
Yeah, so rather... Yeah, so... It's... What is the role, you know, in a sense? How does it show up? What are you called to do in regard to this work when you start to offer it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we call it the work, or, you know, the offering. What are you... You know, you come into some place of deep clarity, and... The impulse of inspiration is, I just need to share this somehow, and I need mm-hmm. to also help. That's part of it, like, you know, because you come to this clarity and because you see other people suffering is, you know, contingent on some ideas and some ways of being that can be, you know, purified, and they can come to you can relieve the suffering of another, help relieve the suffering of another, or point them to, you know, the relief of suffering. But of course, you know, how does that show up in the world then? You know, show you, I'm a teacher, or I'm a whatever.
Yeah.
But it was so recently a talk with some very interesting a person who pointed out to you for in a spiritual sense that, you know, your actual role in being is more akin to the mystic than the, say, teacher per se.
Yeah, and it's like when she sort of said that, yeah, it's like I could feel it energetically sinking into my body. It was like someone had tuned the radio to exactly the right station.
Yeah.
And my body was like, ah.
Yeah. The recognition of that reality. I mean, you call it the mystic in more Western terms, but, you know, you call it Nyani in let's say the Eastern terms.
Because I never sat well with this role of teacher or guru or these kind of roles to me. Although, you know, you could say, oh, these are the same thing, but...
Well, it's where you're teaching from, and you're teaching, or where are you pointing from? Where are you sharing from? Where are you, you know, where is this, these words that are, and these pointings and these insights that are being offered up in support of satsang and the pointing, helping another to come to clarity. Where's that coming from? It's coming from the mystic experience of being itself.
Yeah. And I think more specifically for me, what was really being spoken of is the mystic of the heart, I think. I would broadly define my path or the way that I'm drawn to is, the way of the descent into the
spiritual heart.
Spiritual heart, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's taken me years to be able to articulate that, and I still feel like I'm quite poor at really articulating that in terms of my own path. And so, yeah, this book download was very interesting because, just to give more specifics, it was literally Divine Mother sort of feeding me line by line the chapter titles and subtitles. And I'd write it down on my phone, and I was really tired, and I'd switch my phone off and close my eyes, and a few seconds later there was another one.
Yeah.
And this went on for, I don't know, 2-3 more hours, and I just wanted to go to sleep.
Yeah, the when the muse wants to be heard.
Yeah. And so it was very interesting because it highlighted for me how this path has unfolded post-awakening. And mm-hmm. it's the path of the mystic, really. It's the path of the descent into the heart
mm-hmm.
For me post-awakening, actually.
Yeah.
And also the path of how I teach and how I am in the world, I guess.
Well, it makes me think a little bit about, you know, we were both very heavily involved in a particular movement, you know, a spiritual movement. And, you know, it's a global institution, Maharshi at the head of it. And, And there's all these programs and techniques and very structured knowledge and all this kind of stuff. And it seems in many ways, it's definitely deeply experiential, no doubt about that. And the focus is on that sort of experiential part of it. And I'm grateful for the, you know, the how useful that those techniques were to genuinely introduce me to my own nature. But there's all this sort of...
The structure
of knowledge. And it seems like, it could seem like there's this ladder of attainment that you just step on each rung yeah. before this and then that. And it seems to be a highly technically, a technical unfoldment of a sort of an inevitable structure of attainment.
Yeah. Which you see in other traditions as well.
Exactly. And that's what happens when the things become formalized. But, you know, the mystic is beyond that.
Yeah,
the attainment itself is beyond those considerations. And it's much wilder. It's much more unpredictable. And it's prone to fresh, ever fresh expressions in all those who actually come into the fullness of cognition of it.
And it's a path led by the heart, led by the divine. It's not a path led by knowledge or experience or understanding or any of these things, or by another, or by a tradition, or by structure. I loved when you said wild, because that's exactly how I've experienced my own unfoldment, has had a wildness to it.
Yeah.
And so much of that then for me is about trust and surrender, trusting that wildness and surrendering to that wildness. Mm-hmm. And that's the heart to me. It defies all explanation.
Yeah, and contains all possible contradictions.
Yes, it does. It's a path that isn't for everyone. But I feel all paths lead to it.
Yeah, I it's interesting. It just the thought repeats on me. I might have even mentioned here in this podcast, I read something about Jung, who had said that actually paradox more closely demonstrates or describes the nature of reality than non-paradox. This either or thinking is a binary, an exclusive binary, but the both and the presence of completely opposite ideas existing together in the same space of being is actually closer to reality.
Yeah,
so there's I am large, I contain multitudes. Do I contradict myself very well?
One of my favorite quotes.
So that holding, and it's that's what you're saying, it's the heart, the spiritual heart, the mystic heart holds those contradictions. It doesn't need to be either or. It's both and. It's this can coexist with that in completely paradoxical ways.
It sort of defies all rules in that way.
Exactly.
And so that's often why people who are drawn to the mystic path, they have a hard time fitting into any structure, any tradition, any one singular tradition. They might find themselves, traversing in and out of traditions and drawing from all traditions by way of coming to further trust and sit into the wildness of their own heart.
Well, it's interesting. I see these traditions in many ways as, and you know, spiritual, you know, organizations or whatever that are kind of very formal and make their offerings in formal ways. I see them as scaffolds or training wheels. They're useful. They're useful to guide the seeker into a certain where to look. You know, in a world of a mad diversity, you need these organizing principles to point you back to what's essential, the ground, the self, consciousness, being, the spiritual heart, whatever. And all of these, they aim to point you at that. But once that's been fully realized, it's burst beyond any possible, it's beyond it's beyond the means by which you arrived at it.
Well, they actually, the means become a straitjacket then.
Well, it's the raft, isn't it? It's the Buddhist idea of the raft. You know, all of these teachings, all of this Dharma is the raft that is intended to be a vehicle to get you to the other shore. And when you get to the other shore, you step off and sink the raft. It's fine. But of course, from the viewpoint of those within those traditions, as an aside, it seems that, oh, you're not you know, adhering to the, you know, the various provisions.
Sorry, I interrupted you there. I know for a fact that in every tradition I have been a member of, and I don't want to speak for you, but I know you you probably fit into this as well, that I would be seen as a heretic.
Yeah, right.
In all of them.
I love that.
In all of them. The TM, the Muji, and the Raza, the transmission. I know I'm seen as that in all of those traditions. And that has caused great pain at certain points when transgressing each of those moments in my life. Yeah. It has been quite painful.
Right.
To let go of those traditions that were no longer serving, they were actually hindering.
Yeah.
And it's caused great pain because it was a loss of community. It was a loss of standing, of a sense of belonging, a sense of care by that community, and sometimes livelihood and job, you know, all of that as well. And so it has been, you know, difficult. And here we sit in a town with no physical community around us, in a spiritual community at least. And in many ways, it's you and I, and we're on our own. I have always had a spiritual community around me. And for years now, we haven't. We do online, but physically we don't.
Yeah.
And that's been difficult. That's been a challenge of its own. But I think life has not made a mistake with that, for me at least.
No.
Because it's required. It's like all of that got torn away so that I could finally sort of step into the mantle. Is that the right word? Mantle? Step into the, I don't know what the right
take
word
the mantle.
Is. Of what I needed to, of the calling that had been there for so long, but I couldn't recognize it. I couldn't fully own it. Couldn't fully sort of take that into my heart.
Yeah. I think you have to, you know, you have to go forth. I mean, there's this idea of go forth, leaving everything behind. It's like it's in Jesus, you know, gets baptized on the River Jordan, and then he immediately goes forth into the wilderness for 40 days and nights. Gets tempted by the, you know, but he's on his own. I mean, there's nothing. He leaves all community behind, all family, all friends, whatnot. You know, and the Buddha does, you know, similar things. Goes, all right, that's it. I've got to leave my princely life and go off and you know, in the Jews going off, you know, after being liberated from the Egyptians, and they go off and they wander for 40 years. So they're freed. It's interesting. So there's this beautiful sort of metaphor of going forth and reality, but this idea that you do have to leave everything behind. And it's not always going to be like in the case of, say, you know, the Israelites going off into being liberated from oppression. It is not all sweetness and light for the first bunch of time. It's like, yes, you're freed from tyranny, but you're destitute and you're without a rudder, and you don't know what's what, and you have to find your new way on your own
and not relying on the structures that made sense in that environment. And that can be really hard, because it's certainly led to times where I've felt really lost, even in recent times, you know, like I'm like, I don't have anyone to rely on here. I don't have any resource to fall back on.
Or authority to defer to.
Exactly, that's exactly what I mean. And it's like, no, I have to chart my way through this. Sometimes in darkness, in terms of the tunnel forward, the way forward is not super clear. And it's been that way, particularly, I mean, it's been that way across the board, but but particularly with the transmissions and the work I'm doing, I've had guidance of Divine Mother, but that's so hands-off. It's so subtle, that guidance is. So it's not someone literally going, okay, now do this, now do that, now do that. And it has been some elements of that in my experience. Yeah. But for the most part, it is a sense of tenderness, of care, of support, yes, of heldness that has been there from her, rather than, okay, now you've got to do it like this. There have been some of that moments, but for the most part, it has been a discovery of what feels right.
Right. And also a trust and a reassurance intermittently, it seems.
Yes.
Also with some sort of continuity, but intermittently that, like, yes, you're doing it.
That's been helpful.
this work is my work, kind of thing. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's I don't know what I would have done without that, actually. But
but that was a very unexpected, you know, the relationship with the Divine Mother as it's shown up for you at very, very particular times, places, ways, and more deeply. And that's got to be a big surprise. You weren't expecting that, you know, from, you know, you're a yogi and then you're a sort of a jnani and now and then. Do you know what I mean? It's like the contexts in which you understand one's own being and doing. That's a bit
coming
field.
From the world of non-duality, which is basically flattens the whole thing in some ways.
Yeah.
It can do, at least if it's in the intellectual understanding of it, can flatten the whole thing into the negation of spirits and divine beings and all of this is not it's just part of the dream, so to speak. And while it is, just part of the dream, there is still the dream to contend with. And the dream can have such a richness and such a vitality and bring so much forth within that. And that's been my experience, because I've really had this, for years, had this hard time of, you know, this, she was showing up in my life in this form, Mother Mary form. And I'm like, hang on. This is not my conception of how all of this works.
No, it's certainly not your tradition. Yeah.
And yet you cannot deny the reality of your own experience. Yeah. And so that has taken a long time for me to come to terms with that. Of like, how does this work? What does this mean? In fact, I had a friend ask me that a couple of months ago now. Sort of like this friend was struggling themselves with the ignited sense of, it wasn't Mother Mary in their case, but that sort of sense of something of an entity beyond,
a form of the divine, let's say,
yeah,
the
exactly.
living form of the divine, yeah,
and how to rectify that in their own recognition to do with their tradition and the way they'd been taught.
Definitely. I mean, I've struggled with this stuff. But, you know, it's definitely a point of, you know, the oneness of being is the self-evident reality. And yet there's this mad multiplicity going on. Mm. And, you know, and this notion that the divine is taking form this is the divine taking form. And is it anything other than our own nature? And then getting into sort of devotional relationships with particular forms of the divine other than, you know, particular forms of the divine.
Yeah. And to me, there is no contradiction.
Without the sense that there's a contradiction. Again, it's part of that paradox. It's part of that mystic mystery.
Exactly. There used to be a contradiction there that I couldn't find my home with. And I think that was part of my journey of the rejection of Divine Mother as she was starting to appear to me was that no, this can't be. This is just in my imagination. This is just a thought. This is blah, 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 blah. And really a rejection of that notion of even that possibility. Mm-hmm. And where I sit now today, I mean, it's taken years to come to this place for me, but like, to me, there is no contradiction.
No.
In the same way, there is a no contradiction of the fact that you are the self and I am the self, and yet here you and I appear.
Yes.
There is no contradiction for me there. why would there be any other contradiction for the unseen as much as the seen?
Yeah.
So to me, that's where it sits. It sits that, yes, there is deep devotion and love and tenderness towards Divine Mother in the form of Mother Mary for me.
Mm-hmm. But also, it is nothing other than the oneness of self and God, and which is just the one. Yeah.
She is no other than the self. She is no other than me as well. There is no contradiction in there. There's a paradox in there. There's a both and, yes. Mm-hmm. But it's not a contradiction. It's not a separation. It is how life is showing up, and it shows up that way. And it's been, for me, a beautiful richness of life to explore life in this manner. Mm-hmm. And I was entirely closed off to it. And I didn't go looking for this at all, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it continues to be a great lesson for me.
So, yeah, you got a basically book two downloaded, which was intended to be book three, but book two.
Yeah.
Because your book, anyway, talking of books, you've got, what do you call it? Your proof copy sitting in front of you, which is nice. Your poetry book called
The Heart That Knows.
Great. Which is your debut.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. So that's going to be out and available. It's on, actually, you could pre-order it now on Amazon if you want to.
The ebook,
The ebook.
Not the print copy. The whole release is happening on the 24th.
So it'll all be out. You can just go and buy it. And read it. Enjoy it. Sink into it.
Yeah. It's a transmission.
Yeah.
It's a meditation. It's an invitation. Yes, it's in the form of poetry, and that poetry has very devotional flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a scary thing to put it out there in many ways, because it's like my inner heart on a page. And I'm well aware that that might not land for everyone. They might not hear it in the manner, and that's fine. But it's for me, it was a book that had to come into being. It started pouring out like late last summer. But it's very tender. It's very raw and very tender for me to put that out into the world, because it does feel like I'm standing there naked.
It's your sort of bhakti side, isn't it? I mean, it's that kind of that quality of devotion, that quality of bliss and love towards the divine nature of being. And each of these poems are sort of meditative. My experience, they take you somewhere.
That's their intention.
That's their intention. That's where they come from, and that's where they return you to.
Yeah.
So, but that's the back. And you know, as an aside, that so much of, I see so much of the awakening scene, which is very non-dual in many ways, is sort of a little bit...
Yeah, where's the love?
You could say it's a bit masculine almost. I'm reluctant to use those terms too much, masculine and feminine, but why not? But it's of the mind.
Yeah.
It's
focused on the silence.
Seeing through the mind, the silence, the Purusha value, the silent being. And it isn't... hasn't the fullness of Shakti, Divine Mother, But what's crazy is that if you look at these deep in traditions like Vedanta and Advaita and these paths. Funnily enough, the other night I was watching a short YouTube about one of Ramakrishna's living devotees, and he was talking about Ramakrishna, and he was just a really interesting, beautiful, interesting, powerful sage. That there he was in oneness, complete, indubitably, awakened to the highest degree, and yet he was a total devotee of Kali Ma, absolutely devoted to Kali Ma. And you'd have these sages come through town and meet with him, and he was so obviously and clearly a very, exalted, enlightened being. And, you know, were questioning him on his sort of devotional, you know, on his devotional ways. And they're going, well, non-dual, it's all one or one.
This
and he
was it.
Going, he said, I want it both. I want it both. I want the both. Silence and the, the absolute and the relative, because it is the both.
It is
and
the
so
both.
And so you can fall around, you know, in utter devotion, bhakti to life, to ma, to God, to what, however you want to. It's that, that movement of devotion that arises within the self, aimed at the self in forms, in the formless. It's all fine.
It's all.
And it's a function. But he was talking about in this little video, this talk about the various forms of the divine, forms of God, that the kind of what he called them, Ramakrishna called them the ice that doesn't melt. That you know, like all forms fall away, melt like ice into the ocean of being. But somehow that very the absolute being that is self, that is God, also has these structures and forms as an absolute and eternal part of itself as well.
These so, flavors, these fragrances, that's what I, how I interpret it is like these divine expressions show up in our lives. And yes, they are still consciousness that we are, but they hold within them, they imbibe a certain fragrance, a certain reflection, a certain texture of life that brings with it lessons in that form, in that way.
Yeah.
And that's how I would describe my relationship with Divine Mother, Mother Mary, is it's a certain fragrance, it's a certain texture, it's a certain flavor of life that came to me because that was the flavor that was ripe for me.
But here's the thing, she's a living presence for you.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't just some ambient passing.
No.
You know, there's, you know, and in the same way as, you know, let's look at it a different way. We are one. There is only one, and yet I sit here with you as a nominal other, in trust that all these different beings exist within and as being.
Yes.
So. We're not separate, and yet we dance together.
Yeah, she's as real to me as you are, her and others actually that show up. Not maybe in the same physicality of you,
but that's the
but
point.
But even that, there is some physicality there.
Yeah.
Even then, there is
yes,
physicality
it's subtle,
there. It's a different
subtle
kind
bodies,
of different kind of physicality, but. But yeah, her presence is just as well known as your presence is to me and anyone else's presence is.
Yeah.
Consciousness embodied.
So what's the new book about?
Well, we've been talking about it, so I think people probably get the joke. It's the new book, it, broadly speaking, and it was unexpected. Like
after
I said,
this book.
No. After this book. Oh, what is the new book that's about to come out?
No, I'm... Might as well press. So the book that's currently coming out is your book of poetry, The Heart of the Nose, right? So that's coming out on the 24th. But it's funny, as an artist myself in the past, I always noticed when I finished one work, I was like, next.
Yeah, that was a bit of a, you said that to me, I think it was today or yesterday anyway, you said that to me.
Yeah.
And I was like.
So it's not even out yet.
No, it's not. One. I said, it's not even out. Yeah, I wanted to take a break, like give me a breath.
You obviously not.
Yeah, so
we'll see anyway.
I had already started on what I thought was going to be the second book. Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, I had the outline for all of that. But yeah, the third book, which is now going to probably be the second one. We'll see. I don't know. It's all, I've got it all written down, the whole outline of it. And it is biographical.
Yeah.
But it is very particular to my story around Divine Mother and the transmissions and how they are intimately intertwined with my own spiritual growth and the work that I do. And so that's the, it's not a generalized biography. It's a very specific one about, my descent into the heart, really.
Neat.
We'll see. No promises. I don't know. It's there though. The outline's there. I just don't know how long it'll take to write.
Well, cool.
Watch this space. To me, it speaks of this thing where when we step out of our own way, we become this vehicle of life. And we were talking about this in terms of satsang the other day, of like how when you step out of the way, you sort of surrender yourself to be in service of life. It's like, okay, this is what's coming through now. This is how the manner in which life is expressing itself through me, yes. But it's that process. And so much of this for me is that.
Getting out of your way.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I think, you know, surrender, let's say, starts this idea of surrender or kenosis even, you know, self-emptying.
Yeah, I think that's probably the better word, really. Yeah.
You know, begins at what seems to be a personal level. And then the more completely, let's say, one steps out of the way and empties oneself out, one's own desires, wants, needs, more and more surrender, thy will be done, thy will be done, right? You know, it's a personal plea and prayer and just taking hands off off. In the end, all of what was you just disappears and you realize there's none of you here. It is only the divine act moving out. There's no little self left, in a sense. The self is entirely a function of the movement of big self.
Yeah, well, just to reiterate even what you said, small self is the big self. Yeah. Even the ego, the mind, the body, all of it is grace dancing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, although it starts on a kind of a personal, that it just sort of dissolves it all away in the end. You know, surrender becomes less, and we often explored this, and the prescription and the activity of the person faithfully engaged in at a certain point falls away and is replaced or seen to be the action of grace itself.
Yeah, the last veil is lifted that says, no, I was doing this, and the recognition of, no, this was just what
I was
happening.
Always being carried in this. And
That's, I think, a veil that gets lifted.
Yeah.
Reminds me of that quote. And you're going to have to pick me up on pick up from where I'm starting here, because I, of course, can never remember quotes accurately. I think it was, please correct me, Sun San, was it, who said, if you're going to teach, just
Sun
teach.
Sun San? Yeah. Yeah, if you're going to teach, teach. I can read out, actually. I've got it sitting around. I love this. Okay, Sun San, who was a great Zen. I think he was Korean, actually. I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, he was a Zen. He said, when you teach other people, just teach. Only teach. Only help them. Don't worry whether or not they understand. Only try. If you are trying 100%, then your teaching is complete and your mind light will shine on them. Someday they will understand this. So don't worry. Just try. Trying is better than a Zen master, better than a Buddha, better than God. It is already great love, great compassion, and the great bodhisattva way. So don't check your feeling, don't check your mind, don't check your understanding, don't check outside.
Yeah.
That's very much how I approach all of it.
Exactly. It's beautiful.
You just can't, you know, if you're constantly referencing some sense of personal understanding, When you know, when you're in, you're giving satsang, you, when you're in, you know,
inquiry,
you know, if it's like, oh, well, non-duality doesn't say that, then you're missing that intuitive wellspring from which wisdom spontaneously arises in response to the need of that moment.
Yeah.
And not to dismiss entirely, you know, the value of venerable teachings. Absolutely. Just tremendous. But
you have to learn to not be referencing your knowledge and what you think you should be saying, mm-hmm. but instead to tune into the knowingness in your heart and let the words and the wisdom come forth from that.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we'll leave it there for this week. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you feel to, please like, subscribe, and share, as they say.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye for now.